Hi, and welcome into the 19th Hole Golf Show. My name is Ryan Ballingy. You can email me, ryan@thegolfnewsnet.com. Follow me on Twitter, @RyanBallingy. Follow my work at golfnewsnet.com, as well on Yahoo Sports, sports.yahoo.com, on the Devil Ball Golf blog. Got a great show for you this week. There is no set time limit. We typically go 25 to 30 minutes on the show, but so much has happened in the last week or so since we've broadcast that we've got to get to it all or as much as we can without exhausting you and exhausting me. But before we get into that, I want to tell you a little bit about something that I'm doing next week for the Open Championship that I'm really excited about. I've started a partnership with a site called Rebel.tv, R-A-B-B-L-E.tv. And it's a really fascinating concept. The idea is that it gives an opportunity for people like me, or you for that matter, to broadcast live during a sporting event as alternative coverage to what you hear on the TV. For years, you've probably heard watching baseball, turn down the TV sound and turn up the radio. So listen to radio broadcasts. I do that. And from time to time, you probably, if you follow me on Twitter or follow some of my friends on Twitter in the media, you probably tune us in more than you tune in the play-by-play coverage of your favorite golf events. Well, we're going to be blending some of those elements together at Rebel.tv for 2 hours each day during the Open Championship and throughout the summer's biggest golf events. I'll be providing alternative coverage with my insights, my, whether you want to call it wisdom or not, and other goodies, and we'll have some surprise guests come in and join the fun as well. So we'll give you more information on golfnewsnet.com and on my Twitter account as we get closer to Open Championship week and through the week to give you an idea about when the broadcast times are, how to listen during the live broadcasts as well, how to listen after the fact. We'll have on-demand clips as well, but you're able to listen on your phone or a mobile device through an iOS app, and an Android app is coming soon. So Rebel.tv, R-A-B-B-L-E.tv is the address if you want to check it out, either to listen to broadcasts ahead of mine of the Open Championship or to figure out how to do it for yourself. But Rebel.tv, I'm excited to work with them. So hopefully you'll join me on that adventure starting next week at the Open Championship at St. Andrews. All right, so let's start the program with Donald Trump. I haven't talked about Donald Trump in about a year and 5 months on this broadcast in any kind of serious way. And I actually went back and listened to a show I did in February 2014, not too long after the PGA merchandise show that year, when all of the big talk was about this concept of hack golf, how we were going to save the sport and come up with these brilliant ideas. And Donald Trump was a big part of that to an extent, because he had just made such a big name for himself in the sport with all of the purchases he had made at fire sale prices for Doral and Turnberry, and he had basically amassed an enormous portfolio that was a pretty big deal and made him a prominent player in the sport. And we wanted to assess at the time whether that was a good thing for golf at all, at large, high end, whatever. The end result was it seemed like a good thing for a guy of Trump's celebrity to buy into the sport at a time where most people are running away from it, or poo-pooing it, or worried about its future, what have you. And I'm one of those people that's worried about golf's future, to an extent. And we came to the conclusion that Trump may be good for the high end of the sport, which is actually doing just fine without him, but would not be good for the lower end of the sport, the middle to lower end of the sport, because he's not doing anything really for public facilities, the daily fee golfer, the casual player, someone who's just getting into the sport. That's not who he is. It's not what he's interested in. And he's backed up those comments and saying that golf should be elitist. It should be aspirational. It should be something that is hard to afford. And that means he is in the right business of high-end, high-net-worth individuals who go to these private facilities that are overly manicured and all that stuff, that the Trump way, the over-the-top way, that he's in the right business. And for whatever reason, golf made the decision that he's right and that his vision is good and that he and his money need to be aligned with golf's greatest championships and its most important bodies. And so the USGA, which had a previous relationship with him through the 2009 USA Amateur Trump National Bedminster in New Jersey, furthered that relationship, giving them the 2017 U.S. Women's Open at that same facility. The PGA of America, after a prior administration headed by CEO Joe Steranko, balked at working with Trump, a new administration headed by CEO Pete Bevacqua, and since ousted President Ted Bishop, got into bed with Trump and signed a long-term partnership with him that put the PGA's Grand Slam of Golf, which is not all that big of a deal in the scheme of things, but is a significant tournament and a television right that they own, put that at Trump National Los Angeles for 4 years, put their PGA Junior League Championship there, put their Senior PGA Championship in 2 years' time at his Trump National Washington facility across the Potomac River in Northern Virginia, and they put the 2022 PGA Championship at Trump National Bedminster in New Jersey. PGA Tour also has a standing relationship with Trump by force, in part, because he owns the Doral Resort in Florida, which has been the host to a PGA Tour event for over a half century and hosts the WGC Cadillac Invitational. The same week, he hosts the opposite field, Puerto Rico Open, at his Puerto Rico facility. Then on top of all that, he has Turnberry, which will host the Women's British Open at the end of July, is likely to host another Open Championship because of its standing and importance in recent Open Championship history. And he owns several golf courses in Scotland, which are slated to potentially host the Scottish Open, which is the precursor to the Open Championship. This guy, Donald Trump, owns a lot of important golf venues, or at least ones that are important right now with the way that they've been aligned for future major championship consideration, and that, in fact, they will host future major championships. I know that if you're listening to this show, you're probably going to agree with my viewpoint. So I'm not going to rehash the viewpoint that Donald Trump needs to be removed from the game. He needs to be excommunicated. He needs to be eliminated as part of be known as a representative of the sport of golf. Donald Trump cannot be that. He cannot. Not as a guy that says most people who come across the border from Mexico are illegal and most are rapists. That is completely unacceptable for a person to say that is running for the presidency of the United States, much less a guy who has dominion over a bunch of major championship sites and regular golf tournament sites in a sport where there is a lot going wrong here in terms of golf and its relationship with gender, with race, with income equality. James Corrigan of The Telegraph put it very, very well in his column. It's something you should read. And James and I don't always agree, but he's got a very good point here. Golf is on not so solid footing. It's on uncertain footing if it tries to get on the high horse and tell Donald Trump that he is wrong and should be punished financially in terms of prestige for the things that he said and continues to stand by. And he's right. Look at Augusta National. It struggled for years with race and gender. Still struggles with those things, but there are now minorities by race and gender that are at least a part of the club membership. The RNA is still, despite the fact that the Royal and Ancient Golf Club of St. Andrews has female members, still has a sexist reputation. The Women's British Open is not called the Women's Open Championship. It is run by the Ladies Golf Union. It is cast off as a third-rate property, even behind the Senior Open Championship. Not so good. The European Tour doesn't exactly have the best record of going to countries with solid human rights records. Look at the countries in the Middle East that it goes to on an annual basis. China does not have the best human rights record. It has a poor one, in fact. And there are other countries where its subsequent umbrella of tour events, the Challenge Tour and the Senior European Tour, or European Seniors Tour, go to that aren't exactly the best governments either for human rights. So golf isn't exactly in a position to say, what the hell are you saying, Donald Trump? We have to, as a sport, look at this through a prism of how we're viewed as a prism in the general public. And I think that's what causes, in part, the visceral reaction to go, get this guy the hell out of this sport. Because you don't want to reaffirm all the things that you know about golf. And those are ugly things. The past is ugly. And it's still there. I mean, there's still remnants of the golf world. And I don't know how big that pocket is, so I'm not going to make a broad statement. But there are parts of the golf world that not necessarily agree with Trump entirely, but they agree with him somewhat. That they don't have a problem separating themselves as wasp men from women, from minorities, from immigrants, from the poor, whatever. That golf is a respite from the undesirable part of society. And that, going forward, is not an attitude that our game can stand. I don't care. Again, James is a great point. We've been there and we're doing it. Going forward, this sport cannot be that. I cannot disagree more with the postulate that Trump made that golf should be elitist and difficult to afford. That is not the future of golf. That is not the future, really, of anything. We are moving as a society in a very strange direction. We are moving as a society, at least in this country, toward more freedom, more individual opportunity for happiness. We are trying to give more people more freedom to do the things that they were shunned from doing or that they couldn't do, while simultaneously building an economic ecosystem where it is almost impossible for those same people who get freedom to advance economically. The wealth that has moved as a result of whatever you want to call this recovery after the Great Recession has been largely to the top, and I mean 99% to the 1%. You and I, even if you do well and you make six figures and you listen to this podcast, there is a very good chance that you have not seen much economic benefit from the recovery that has been undergoing, this country has been undergoing for 7 years now, or supposedly undergoing for 7 years now. So there is more wealth stratification than ever in this country, which means the people at the very top, like Trump, are doing great, and they're totally fine with how things are, because that means they can afford it and they can keep people that they don't want out and kind of live in their own ecosystem. They can take over the world and live in it as they want, and we're just there to be there. That's something that needs to be fought, and I truly believe that. You can call me a liberal, you can call me a whatever liberal name you want in the book. If you're an avid Fox News watcher, I'm here to tell you that philosophy is what is going to ultimately destroy our country. So, I believe in a philosophy where we want to uplift as many people as possible through economic policy. That ultimately, that prism, that view of the world has an impact on the sport of golf, because golf is down as a sport because the people in the middle class, upper middle class, and lower middle class that took up the sport voluntarily when times were good in the mid-90s and 2000s, and early 2000s, when they took up the sport, they were the first to go away. And they were the first to go away because they ran out of money in their pocket. And when it comes down to buying groceries or playing 18 holes, groceries win. They win. Even cell phone bills win over playing golf. It's just the truth. It's a necessity in society for the most part. So golf is losing because of the economic ecosystem that we have now. So that makes it hard to defend as someone who loves golf. If you're a pure capitalist, you can easily defend it. That's fine. But Trump represents what's happening now. He's fine with that. So if he's fine with that, and if he thinks the undesirables are just rapists and terrible people, or undesirables in his opinion, are all those things that are, you know, affirm his belief, then he is fine with golf going into the tubes. And I can't support that at all. So what does the action need to be? I think you got to break these contracts. If you're the USGA, PGA Tour, PGA of America, and the LPGA, which the LPGA doesn't really have a direct relationship with Trump, that's through other bodies, but they're still represented at the table. And they need to come to Trump and say, look, man, we knew getting into bed with you was a gamble, and we took the wrong one. I'm sorry, but we've got to go. And he could sue golf for millions and millions of dollars, whatever he wants to do. He loves litigation. He loves the bankruptcy courts. Plays them like a fiddle. But golf will win in the end because it potentially infringes on their reputation, their collective reputation as purveyors, as guardians of the sport. That if they align themselves with a guy that says people from Mexico come to this country are typically illegal and they like to rape people, I don't want to be associated with that. I don't. I know you don't either. And if you do, again, you're probably not listening to the show. So I don't want to beat a dead horse too much. But I find it completely underwhelming, the response that golf has made to this point toward Donald Trump. And again, I understand there are contracts. I understand there's legalese, and I understand that there's a threat of legal action that could be protracted and expensive. But guess what? The USGA is getting paid $93 million a year by Fox Sports to broadcast its events. The LPGA won't be involved. The PGA Tour gets a whole hell of a lot of money from Golf Channel for its cable and from NBC and for CBS for the weekend rights to their events. The PGA of America is going to cash in very soon on a new contract. So if money in the kitty is an issue, or thought to be an issue, it is not an issue. Have the fight the fight, and just get it done. And if Trump backs off and recants all of a sudden and says, me, oh my, I'm so sorry, I shouldn't have said that, once the whatever economic impact of this, however meager to his bank account, affects him, you still got to walk away. You can't say something to the effect of what Trump said and go, oh, I'm sorry, didn't mean that. I've stood by it for weeks, but I'm bad. My bad. Slap me on the wrist. Poor me. Me, oh my. No, you got to walk away. Clean break. Shut up and do it. And if there's any shuffling of feet, those feet need to be held to the fire. Need to make a move. And I hope that happens soon. And we get an indication from Randall Mell, who's at the U.S. Women's Open at Lancaster Country Club, who asked USGA Executive Director Mike Davis today about the possibility of moving the 2017 U.S. Women's Open away from Trump National Bedminster. Basically said, all I can tell you is we're looking at it. Well, that's the start of something. You need to look at it harder and faster. You need to finish the job. And the sport needs to move on. Trump is a capitalist and can own all the things that he would like. He can buy up every freaking property in the world. But we don't need another Muscle Shoals. We don't need another Augusta National and Martha Burke. We don't need another Ladies Golf Union. As the sport has collectively realized, it is time to break down the barriers that make it look so stupid and petty to the outside world. We're going to invite another one by standing by this buffoon. No, we cannot do that. All right, let's go into Rory McIlroy. This one's not going to be as fiery, but I've been asked this question a bunch over the last couple of days, and I'm sure I'm going to get it again and again in radio interviews, is what do you think about the notion of McIlroy playing soccer with his friends on July 4th, just a couple of weeks before the Open Championship? Would you do that? Would you endorse that? I think the simple answer is not there. It's complicated. In general, I'm in favor of human beings being able to do what makes them happy. Whole point about freedom I was trying to make with Trump. So, if playing soccer makes you happy, go do it. But realize that there are potential ramifications if you get hurt, something goes wrong, all those things. And Rory McIlroy's hurt himself in the past playing soccer. And he talked about it a couple years ago. Jeff Shackelford found the quote, said McIlroy admitted he probably shouldn't be doing that anymore. But that said, you can't, as Mickelson said at the Scottish Open, you can't live your life in fear. You can get hurt in the shower. You can get hit by a car and not know it. All kinds of things can happen to you that you cannot stop. You can't predict. So how are you able to predict a rolled over ankle that's going to ultimately keep him out of the Open Championship, maybe the PGA Championship, which he's also supposed to defend in 3 weeks after next week, as well the WGC Bridgestone Invitational, get the FedEx Cup, after that the race to Dubai. There's a lot on the line for McIlroy here in terms of on-course and off-course earnings. Can you put a price on that? Can you say, well, if I hurt myself, it costs this amount of money to me, potentially. And then just go, well, that's too much. I can't do it. There's time for soccer when I'm 40. I'm 35 and 40. And I'm not relevant anymore. That's not a way to live your life. You can't live your life waiting to do the things you want to do. Whether that's play soccer on July 4th, start a business, save up for something, whatever your life goal is, hashtag life goals, whatever that is, you can't just wait for it. You got to make it happen. I speak about that from experience. So kudos to McIlroy for doing it. And kudos to him for saying, I'm not going to force the issue. I'm just going to get the hell out of the way and let the Open Championship happen. He made the decision early enough so that Russell Knox knows he's in, can prepare, get ready for the championship as the first alternate now on the field. That's good stuff. That's fine. Sport will be fine. I don't think there will be a taint there long term if Spieth wins the next two majors and McIlroy isn't a part of either of them. It's not gonna be like, as people remember in 08, where Patrick Harrington won the final two majors of the year and went, but Tiger wasn't there. Over time, people have kind of forgotten about that. Well, also people have forgotten that Patrick Harrington won three majors in a 14-month span. So there you have it. It's Larry Nelson of our generation. But if Spieth goes on to win all four majors, he still beat a collective, more or less, 500 guys, 500 players. Now, obviously, a lot of crossover there. But more or less 500 guys to win the Grand Slam in a year. The fact that one guy, even as talented as McIlroy is, would not be there for two of them, that shouldn't set it back. Just shouldn't. Because quite frankly, when Tiger was going for it in 02, there was really nobody there that was worthwhile to challenge him. We were still a few years away from Phil Mickelson being a major winner. Sergio Garcia was a head case. Ernie Els was good, but not great. Kind of backed into that one at Muirfield. So Rich Beam got the best of Tiger Woods at Hazeltine later that summer. But that was kind of a fluke. So, again, having McIlroy not there stinks. We'd love for him to be there, but that has nothing to do with whether or not Spieth's Grand Slam is valid or whatever if he does it. So just get that out of your head right now. Last topic of the week I want to get to is Scott Stallings. And I'm surprised this hasn't been talked about more in one sense than another. I'm not surprised at all. But Scott Stallings has been suspended 3 months by the PGA Tour for self-admitting to taking a substance, DHEA, which essentially is an anabolic steroid or form of a steroid that helps to increase testosterone production. Sometime last year, last fall, started feeling really sluggish. Guy's 30 years old, he's got a two-year-old kid, or, you know, a new kid, and just felt like he couldn't keep up. And I understand the feeling. I have a hard time keeping up, but I also don't feel like I need testosterone. But he went to his doctor. His doctor said, look, I'll give you this. I recommend you take this supplement, DHEA, 25 milligrams a day, with a caveat that's cool under the PGA Tour's drug policy, which he didn't know one way or the other. The doctor didn't. And Scott Stallings didn't look at the drug policy, drug manual, to find out that it was a banned substance. So he took it for a few months and then passed a drug test at Humana. We'll come back to that. Then a couple weeks later at Torrey Pines, where he's a past champion, was defending champion. Had a meeting, said, you know, the Olympics are coming. Got to really be vigilant about this drug policy stuff. Make sure you familiarize yourself with the manual. We're going to be more stringent, blah, blah, blah. And then Stallings looks at the manual and goes, oh crap, the thing I took is illegal. Tells the PGA Tour. Then it takes them a month to tell him that he did violate the rules, even though he admitted to violating the rules, which is tantamount to a positive drug test under the policy. And then, for some reason, it took another 2.5 months for them to actually suspend him for 3 months, which makes him eligible October 4th just in time for the start of the next season, just in time for the end of this season. Stallings is exempt because he won at Farmers. He's exempt for two additional seasons, so he's okay. That's fine there. One more season, I should say. So I have a couple questions about this, and Steve Elling brought them up very succinctly in a posted golf blog. And if you're not reading Steve's new work, it's good. It's fiery. I mean, it's kind of unfiltered, and I like that about him because that's when he's at his best. But there are so many questions asked. So, one, how in the world did Scott Stallings pass a piss test in January taking a substance that was illegal? So the PGA Tour only does urine testing. They don't do blood testing, which means they can't catch HGH. And this means that the testing either wasn't good enough or that for some reason there was a lull in his samples, two samples he provided, that it didn't find a marker on the test. So how good's the drug testing? Probably not that great. Then there's the next question. The guy admitted to it. He said, I took it. That should be enough for a positive test. Write it down. Do the formal process. Go, okay, well, you're going to be suspended for a few months. Starting March, here we go. Or whatever. It took them, from the date of the admission, at least four and a half months to dole out the official suspension and let everyone know about it. Now, that's not good. That's way too long. And I don't think it's supposed to be that short of a period. It's supposed to, usually 90 days if you go through the appeal process, which maybe Scott Stallings decided to do in the hopes that he would get some kind of lesser sentence. I don't know. I haven't talked to him about it. But that seems like insanely long to take from a guy admitting to taking an illegal drug to going ahead and suspending the guy. Next question is, how in the world is something prescribed by a doctor available to the general public legally an illegal substance? And I understand anabolic steroids are legal under prescription because they help build you up. And sometimes, I mean, I was prescribed them in the fifth grade. And I took them for a little while in fifth grade. Obviously, I didn't bulk up because I'm fat. But how is that possible? And if it is possible, maybe there needs to be a little bit more nuance in what's determined as illegal in terms of milligrams, dosage sizes, all that good stuff. And then, of course, the traditional questions, anytime this comes up, and this is the fourth time it's come up, third person to actually get a true suspension out of this, that we know of at least, is why is the tour not more specific with information about these cases? Because, and I'll tell you the answer, their view is the public is not interested in these cases. They don't want to know what's going on. They don't want to know all the dirty details. I'm here to tell you, more fans probably want to know than you think. I'm not going to tell you every Tom, Dick, and Harry that tunes in to CBS on Saturday afternoon and takes a nap watching the deer this weekend wants to know about Scott Stallings' suspension. But there are plenty of people who are interested in it and want to understand the nuance behind it, want to understand how a guy won three PGA Tour events and was prescribed something by his doctor, turns out to be illegal, and he has to self-report it for it to get caught and get suspended 4 months later from the admission. That doesn't add up. So, the overall PGA Tour drug policy, again, we've said this before, it needs to be cleaned up, needs to be more transparent, needs to be swifter acting, needs to be more easily understood, not only by the fans, but especially by the players who have no freaking clue how it works. And they apparently have to be reminded several times a year about it. For them to go, oh, we've got this illegal drugs list. Maybe I passed a urine sample that had illegal drugs in it, and they didn't figure it out. Good for Scott Stallings. Good for him to know that he passed the drug test and still turned himself in. I'm not sure a whole lot of people would have done that. So in the end, it makes the PGA Tour look bad. The whole situation does. Of course, it's through the prism what you want to view it. If you just view it Scott Stallings being a good Samaritan and turning himself in, that's the end of the story for you. If you view it along the broader set of questions that the entire situation invites, it looks pretty bad for the PGA Tour. It looks fine for Scott Stallings. He's a good dude, and he made a mistake. But the way that was handled was also a mistake, and that needs to be corrected going forward. lot to get to next week. Obviously, we got a preview for the Open Championship. We may have a guest. We may not. We probably won't have anything more on Donald Trump, so you can cross your fingers on that, not hearing me talk about that one more time. Hopefully, we'll get a sense of Jordan Spieth's positioning heading into the Open Championship based on what he does at the Deer. And we'll see what happens at the Scottish Open, if that portends anything for St. Andrews. Until next week, I'm Ryan Ballengee saying thanks so much for listening, and we'll catch you next week on the 19th Hole Golf Show.